Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Bill Simpkins, and he will be doing a session entitled Wonderful World of Ice and Glaciers. So let's listen in.
My name is Bill Simpkins. I'm the science person here for 2 weeks, and kind of mostly the geology person. That's what I've been concentrating on. I teach geology at Iowa State University in Ames, and have for the last 6 years. And I teach groundwater courses mostly, but I also teach a course in glacial geology, which most recently has become the most popular course. People seem to be really interested in it. And the title of this session is The Wonderful World of Ice and Glaciers. And what we're going to see here is a little bit about ice, a little bit about glaciers, and it's particularly appropriate that the day is a little cooler and we can start thinking about snow up in the peaks again and winter coming on and all the kinds of things that you guys really like. Right. So we're going to see mainly slides here. There's not going to be much theology involved, more geology than theology, actually. As we look through these, I think it's really difficult to not look at the kinds of processes that we're talking about and just kind of be in awe of the scientific and logistical aspects of glaciers themselves and of ice. I don't know if most of you are under the impression that ice is kind of a magical substance, you know, that water is the only compound that we know of that actually is more dense at a higher temperature, and when it freezes, it's actually less dense. And so this is why your milk that you used to put out on the back porch would expand and the milk bottles would break. That's why ice expands. And we're going to talk a little bit about that particular quality, which makes water itself unique among the compounds in the world, which gives it its real beneficial qualities. And anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that. So we're going to talk about glaciers. We're going to talk a little bit about ice. We're going to talk about what glaciers do and all the things surrounding those. So I guess I have control here. Ha. And I'll turn off the lights first. And if you have questions as we're going through these slides, please speak up, because I'm used to fielding those things from students. We've all seen pictures of glaciers, and this particular one is up in Glacier Bay. We've seen pictures of glaciers that are mostly white, that are mostly in mountainous areas, that have a lot of nice broken up lines in them, which we call crevasses. And but you know, the general public themselves don't know too much about what goes into these kinds of things. At least here in Holden Village, we're not directly in contact with ice like this, but we're in contact with many of the glacial types of features. Incidentally, this was an aerial. Is this an aerial view? Yeah. Aerial view that I took when I was up in Alaska. Oh no, you were on the plane too. I think you and I were both in the plane when we took this. Okay. Well, this is a topographic map. If I can get it to hold here, it seems to want to focus itself. Can we turn off? Is there an? There's an automatic focuser on there. I wonder if we can turn that off. It's on the back. If you look in the back, I seem to be doing a better job focusing than that thing is. Is there a button back there? Sometimes there is. Let me. Is that okay? Let's see if it'll kick.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. All right. We can get it in. Okay. Yeah, it looks like maybe there's a little bit of problem with focus. Anyway, this is, in case some of you've seen this, this is an old, out-of-date map that USGS doesn't publish anymore. That is at a scale of 1 to 62,500, which means it's about an inch to a mile. So distances along like this are, you know, kind of like a mile. So we're covering a big area here. But Holden is here, and you can see they've got the Holden Mine. But what's even more impressive are all the features that are related to glaciation that pretty much cover this map. You know, if you go all the way here to Lyman Glacier, which of course still exists, this is a very nice glacial valley that comes down here. Holden Lake is a very nice glacial valley that is a hanging valley that hangs here, caused by a tributary glacier that went into the main Railroad Creek Glacier. Seems to be. What's happening is the screen is kind of moving back and forth as I'm coming to it, so it's getting out of focus. So there are a lot of glacial features here that make this really a classic area for what we call alpine or mountain glaciation. And we're going to talk a bit about how those are. But I think as you walk around, you know, there's a reason why the valleys are this shape. There's a reason why the ridges are sharp. And this is a result of glaciation not only here, but of the whole Cascades as well. Just some pictures. This is looking back on Heart Lake, where I actually was yesterday, towards the valley. And you can see where you would go to Holden Lake, I think back up in here. And pretty steep climb, actually. And you can imagine these valleys being at one time, probably during the last 20,000 years, being pretty much filled with ice. They are not the classic U-shaped valleys that are associated with glaciation, but they come pretty close, and you know, for American standards, they are very good. Some of the better ones are actually in Switzerland, but it costs a lot more money to go there. So, although that's still a sore point in our particular marriage. I shouldn't say that with a family counselor and therapist in the audience. And then there are lots of other features. This is actually Copper Basin. I have not been up there, but that last photo was from Rick Dunning. This is from Rick Dunning. And snow tends to accumulate in depressions such as these, and as the glaciers grow, they form these very large valleys. And you can see that there is kind of a U-shape here, although it's bent out on the sides. But if this were a stream valley, it would be much more V-shaped, and that's one of the characteristics. And this is a view of the Antioch Valley, which you can see if you kind of go over the ridge, and you can see now that these valleys do have the appearance of being fairly deep, and they're also fairly deep in relation to the size of the stream that's in them now. So there's definitely been another process that's gone on in this particular area. This is a view down on Holden Lake up around where Mary Green Glacier is, another one that Rick Dunning took, and also you can see that here's the lake, and then if you go over, there's this huge lip, and this is where the tributary glacier came in and actually went down into the main glacier. It didn't actually go down, it kind of went into it because the ice was filling this valley. So there's been a lot of activity here, and many of the things that we take for granted on hiking trails and stuff are a result of the glacial kind of process. So it would not be too far afield to think of this landscape during the latter part of the Ice Age, or what we call the Pleistocene period, as looking like this, with material filling the valleys, glaciers coming down off these peaks, and a lot of snow and ice laying around. And then later on, you know, perhaps the glaciers came down and were melting away and were further down in the valleys, exposing some of these areas as well. But certainly we don't have as spectacular as some of these slides would suggest, but it's pretty darn close, and the result, it's the result of extensive glaciation.
Where was that last one taken?
I actually shot that out of a book. I suspect that this is in Switzerland.
Does Greenland have the glacier? It looks like it's just nothing but snow in the air.
Well, yeah, it is. It's one big glacier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is kind of my analog to Lake Chelan. Lake Chelan, as many of you know, is in places 1,480 to 1,500 feet deep. Well, you don't get that from a stream valley. The only way you can get that is if you pump a lot of ice into there, and in fact, it's below sea level. If you go into a place like Norway, where they have these things all the time, we call them fjords. And we call them fjords in Alaska, too. But we can't see how deep they are most of the time because they're filled with water. This is an example of a fjord up along the coast of Norway, I think, but I'm not sure. All right, the story begins here with snow crystals. Many of you have noted probably in your life here that, not life here, but life on the planet, that snow crystals are six-sided. And although there are no two that are alike, they all have that, what we call, symmetry about them. And what makes the difference between snow and when we get into a glacier is two things. One is a glacier is an accumulation of snow and ice that has to last from year to year. All right, so it has to be present all the time. It can't just come and then be melted back. The other characteristic is that it actually moves. All right, so that distinguishes glacial ice from a snowfield, for instance. But the story starts out in here, and what happens is that as snow that begins as this very fragile, very light and airy kind of material, as it compounds itself with more of snow on snow on snow, isn't there a song that goes like that? Snow on snow on snow. I always think of glaciation when I think of that song. This ice transforms itself, this is the theology part, that transforms itself to what we call glacial ice through a series of processes. These corners are broken off and the ice becomes very, very compressed. And as a result, things that start out as snow crystals actually become glacial ice crystals. This is a glacial ice crystal. It's all one crystal. It's all, you can think of it as a like a metamorphic rock. In some respects, or a mineral, actually, is probably more correct. And these things can get to be very large, and if you go to the base of a glacier where the snow has been completely transformed to ice, you will see nothing but this. Okay? So it starts out as snow, it piles on top of itself, and through the weight of the snow on top of it, it converts to this. And this particular substance then itself causes the movement of the glacier by what a process we call deformation. In other words, it kind of wiggles around and provides glaciers with movement. And you get some kind of neat things out of glacial ice. This the glacial ice crystals have a threefold symmetry about them, so that you have one long axis going this way and two short ones, and lots of times along the long axis you get these flowers developed. This is what's called a Tyndall flower, and if you look in an area that has glacial ice, you can oftentimes see these kinds of flowers naturally developing on the ice surface. And of course you get ice caves in a glacier, very similar to a regular limestone cave, with this very scalloped appearance. But remember, this is all ice, it's not rock. You can also get stalactites and stalagmites formed. And see things like this. And if you look up into the glacier itself, and here we're at the bottom, you can see very large cracks. And within these areas are large crystals of glacial ice that are probably here thousands of years old. Okay. You'll also notice here that as opposed to the whitish cast of a snow crystal, the cast of a glacial ice crystal has a distinctive blue. And that's no more apparent than when you go to the margin of a glacier and actually see blue ice. Blue ice, to my mind, is one of the most spectacular things, I think, about this whole process. What makes the ice blue is the question that people always ask. And probably up to about, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, people thought that it was probably all the dirt in the ice that caused a scattering effect similar to why the sky is blue, okay? But they kind of tested that out, and the more recent theories have suggested that it's actually the ice itself is so compressed, and what by meaning so compressed, it has a density of close to 1, and snow starts out at densities that are like 0.2 or 20% of what very cold water would be. Anyway, it gets so compressed that it doesn't allow, it actually captures red light. All right, the molecules themselves capture the red light, and they're only letting the blue light through. So what we see is actually the blue light. All right, and it's a little harder to understand, a little less intuitive, but they found that, and it works out with the physics of the water molecule at these temperatures and such. But if you you can go to various places, and you know, this is the front of the McBride Glacier, which is what we call calving. It has its margin in water, so it lets off icebergs. And Kathy and I were in a boat together at this point, watching these things fall off occasionally, and they do kick up pretty big waves. And you don't want to be right next to one, of course. This is what sunk the Titanic. If you want to know where icebergs come from, this is one of the main sources, is actually breaking off the margins of glaciers. But you can see here there is a distinctive bluish cast. I mean, it's unmistakable and provides a real exciting contrast to the colors in the landscape.
Can they make blue ice in the laboratory yet? Or are
they... I don't know. They can actually get close to where glacial ice is with the density and stuff. You know, you have to put a lot of pressure on it to get it. You know, when you're talking about ice that's maybe, you know, 1,000 to 3,000 meters thick or something, it's hard to do that in the laboratory, but it can be done. So I thought I might mention here, this is a slide I took just before we left, to talk about the extent of glaciation in North America. Most of us that are familiar with what's called the, I'm losing it here. Rick, help me out. We've got the Cordilleran ice sheet, Laurentide. The Laurentide ice sheet, which covered most of this particular part of America and sent lobes of ice down into the Midwest. We live here in Ames, which is right on this Des Moines lobe here. But those of you around the Great Lakes are very familiar with glacial deposits down here. These are actually what are called continental glaciers, and they were huge. I mean, there were miles of ice back here where they started in Hudson's Bay. Over here in this part of the world, we have what was called the Cordilleran ice sheet, which, in addition to alpine glaciation, actually built up enough ice thickness to send continental lobes down pretty far and actually cause some fairly spectacular features. But the extent of ice in North America during the late Pleistocene, or you know, anywhere from maybe 20,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, was fairly extensive. And the other thing that's interesting here is that it not only changed the landscape, but it changed the distribution of zones of vegetation, so that pretty much next to the ice we had tundra-like conditions that you'd find if you went up in the high mountains. Further to the south, we had things that were more akin to things that are now found further to the north. So the ice actually affected the climate considerably, and that's a big issue now. But glaciation affects most of us. It's the most common material that we put landfills in and things like that, so it's very important. They come in all shapes and sizes. This is the aerial view of the McBride Glacier where we were down in the boat down in here. And you can see features like a medial moraine, a deposit of material that's in the middle of the ice. There are lateral moraines on both sides here, and the medial ones are caused by the merging of the lateral ones when they come out of these mountains. And that happened here too at Holden Village, I'm sure. This is the classic glacial picture. There are some less classic ones like this. If you go up to Mount Rainier, this is the Nisqually Glacier that comes off of Mount Rainier, and you can see it's got a lot of junk on the top of it. It's not white. You know, it's still the same thing. It works the same. It just has a little different history.
In that last picture, how far are we seeing? How far is the back of the picture?
Oh, gosh. Several miles, maybe? I'm trying to think what the scale of the map is that would represent this. I would say maybe a few miles up to here, and then, you know, maybe several miles back up there, and tens of miles up to where the source is. These are big. They're really big. And these are small in comparison to what was here, you know, 15,000 years ago. Okay, the Nisqually. This is the Mendenhall Glacier, in Juneau, those of you that maybe have been there to Juneau on a cruise, perhaps not. Not a lot of response there. We didn't go on a cruise, but it's a real pretty glacier. It has a lake in front of it, very photographable, and you can see that the ice near the barge is really chopped up, and it's an example of just how dynamic the nature of the ice is, especially near the margin. Then we get things like this. This is the Malaspina Glacier, which is off the coast of Alaska. And you can see the moraines here. These dark patterns of debris have been bent around. This is all ice down here as well. And this is the ocean. And this thing has come down, and kind of, you can think of it as, one of my students described it as taking toothpaste and squeezing it and letting it drop onto the floor and watching it pile up. All right, so the glacier gets out here and it kind of piles up on itself. It can't get rid of the stuff off the other end fast enough. So this is the Malaspina, and it's a real nice glacier to go to, except they have probably the highest bear population of any glacier on the continent. So firearms are mandatory kind of gear there. One of the things about glaciers is that they always move forward. Now, they may actually move forward in advance or the retreat, but the actual motion of the ice is forward. And so in a year, if they have snow coming up near the source area where the glacier starts, they have to get rid of water to maintain some kind of balance. And one of the ways it does this is to create holes in the ice that go down to the bottom of the glacier. This feature it's known by a French word. It's called a moulin. And moulins carry water from the surface down the glacier, and then it usually shoots out the bottom. If a glacier is not moving, what that means is that simply the snow that's coming in at the upper end is being balanced by water going out the bottom end. All right, and if it goes either frontwards or backwards, that means that particular balance has been disturbed. That one's out of place. Sorry, that's another shot of a glacier. Nice moraines here, accumulations of debris, and you can think of stuff. You can see that they're coming this way, and so the moraines have merged, and pretty spectacular view there. Okay, here's another moulin, and you can see that this particular one is at the intersection of some cracks in the ice. The ice itself in the upper parts is actually brittle, so it breaks apart, very similar to what ice in your refrigerator would do. It's only with depth that the ice becomes almost a plastic substance that can be molded. But up here, cracks develop, and sometimes at the intersection of these cracks, you'll get these moulins develop. And you can see the amount of water that goes through. You actually get streams running on the ice. You can see here that use my pointer here, streams that run on the ice. And you don't want to fall into one of these. This occasionally happens to people, and then they're found thousands of years later at the other end. And sometimes very well preserved, though, I might add. Crevasses, this is up on the Mary Green Glacier, and you can see some crevasses starting to form up there where the ice is pulling away, actually, from the mountain front. Another picture from Rick. Glaciers themselves are pretty good erosional agents, and if you go up into any of the national parks like Glacier, we were just in Rocky Mountain a week or so ago, you see all these kinds of bowl-shaped depression. This is what's called a cirque. And a cirque is really where a lot of these alpine or mountain glaciers start. They start accumulating stuff, and through the process of accumulation, they kind of etch out a bowl-shaped depression. And so many glaciers now have retreated back into their cirques, but in many cases, the glaciers that we see that are responsible for a lot of the glacial features here actually start in these depressions. And as they erode backwards, they form really steep mountain ridges, which are called arêtes, and we'll see those in a second. This is the infamous Lauterbrunnen Valley in Switzerland. It's kind of the U-shaped valley. And you can see that it actually is U-shaped. Near vertical walls, filled with stuff down at the bottom, so it goes down even further than this. All right, so if you get a really deep, very erosive glacier, and the right kind of rock on the sidewalls here, you get a perfectly U-shaped valley. This is spectacular. I would argue that it is spectacular. Yes. You can see that, hopefully. But in most cases, you get valleys that are a little more, less U-shaped, like these. But again, you can see that if it's with a stream valley, it would be mostly V-shaped and very steep to a V. These have been broadened out by some process, which presumably is glaciation. And when the glaciers are on both sides of a ridge, they erode towards each other, and you can get a knife-edge ridge. This is near Grindelwald in Switzerland. And this is what's called an arête. It's a knife-edge ridge, and it's a French word. These are fun to get up on and climb around on. I've personally done that. But so that's one type of feature that gets formed. You get all kinds of smaller scale features too. This is from Rick Dunning up on the Mary Green Glacier. This is a feature called roche moutonnée, another French term, which means loosely rock mountain. And essentially, the ice has come over this way and sculpted the front side and clipped off the back side. And if you look on the rock itself, you'll see lots of scratches that are made by rocks actually being in the ice. And those are called striations, those scratches. And there are some peculiar features that one can see in Ohio. If any of you have been to Kelly's Island, Ohio, which is off the coast of Ohio and into Lake Erie, you can actually see large grooves that the ice has made at that particular spot on a very, very weak limestone. And this is a pretty neat place to go to for a geologist or really for anybody. You can see that you can imagine rocks kind of at the bottom of the ice gouging out some of this material. So the glaciers themselves erode a lot of material, and when they erode that, they incorporate that into the ice, and then they drop it off at various places. So, like this, when you see a large boulder in the middle of nowhere, chances are that was deposited by a glacier. If you go to Yellowstone Park and you go out to see the various views of the lower falls, there's a glacial boulder at one of the stops that's about this size, and that was brought there by the glacier. A continuing reminder that glaciers do deposit things. The material associated with is what's called till. And till is blankets many parts of the Midwest. It also can occur in what we call moraines, which are accumulations of that material. And moraines, actually, this is a moraine up on the Lyman Glacier that Rick was kind enough to loan me. You can see that it's kind of a rocky mess of a lot of different sizes, and that's very, very typical of that type of material. Here's a real spectacular moraine that was built that actually dammed up a lake, and now you can see the lake has broken through this. This is in Colorado, but a very nice ridge. You can just think of the ice just sitting right in here and then having retreated. Okay, moraines here, you can see these deposits around what was probably the extent of the ice. The ice is now gone, and there's a lake in the middle of it. Very common occurrence. There's a lake in front of Lyman Glacier right now. Hart Lake had a similar kind of origin, except with a little bedrock influence. Lateral moraines, or moraines on the side of the ice, you can see the ice, the Findelin Glacier, this is in Switzerland, is over to the right here, and it's built a moraine off to the left-hand side of it. This was a field trip that I was on in Switzerland that my wife was unfortunately not able to go on and that I'm still paying for. And these are some of our colleagues that are walking along this ridge. We're going up to an alpine hut that we stayed at. And if you look the other way, you can see this pretty magnificent landform. But you can see that the moraine or the debris that's built out from the side of the glacier is fairly extensive here. And because it's very close to the ice, it doesn't get worked on very much. So the boulders are very angular, and it looks like kind of a mess. We had two clear days, absolutely clear days, to see the Matterhorn, which incidentally is actually a feature called a horn, which means that glaciers presumably eroded it on three sides to a peak. There's a lot of controversy actually about whether this is actually a true horn or not, but you can see that it's a glaciated landscape. Well, the glaciated landscape in the Midwest is a little more subtle. I threw this particular slide in. This is the Alexandria Moraine, which is in western Minnesota. If you drive through an area that all of a sudden the topography gets kind of bumpy like this, this is the same kind of moraine that we saw at the margins of these glaciers out here. They're bumpy because there's ice in them and the ice melts at various times. So this is something you might look out for. Other features, this is what's called an esker. And an esker is something that could be formed by water that's traveling at the bottom of the ice in a tube, and then when that tube fills up, it's left as a ridge. Okay, so there was ice over this whole area. This is in Norway or Sweden, I can't remember now. But this thing is miles long, and so you can imagine a river of water carrying meltwater from the ice miles under a huge glacier. And then for some reason, things change, it fills up with sediment, and we're left as a ridge that goes and goes and goes. And the state of Maine, Wisconsin, Minnesota, all of them have very good examples of these. This is another example of a feature that's formed underneath the ice. These are what are called drumlins. And this is a particular drumlin field in Canada that actually has been fairly controversial. Drumlins are basically formed by a kind of a combination of mechanisms, but there are these ridges. You see these very plainly in Wisconsin if you're driving west to east across I-90. 94, and you cut across many of these things. They're fairly large. They can be, a couple hundred feet high, depending on how big the ice was. And they're all aligned in the direction that ice is flowing. Okay, so we can tell that the ice was going like this direction. It's a very good ice flow indicator. Now, this particular drumlin field has caused a lot of controversy. Drumlins, for many people, are formed by existing material that was on the landscape and ice sculpting them. For other people, their mechanism of formation is that they're actually kind of dumped as parts of the bottom of the ice and then sculpted. All right, subtle distinction there. But the newer version is that these are actually eroded by water, and they're actually water-looking landforms. In fact, that idea has come about because they look very much like things that you see in sedimentary rocks as a result of water. Now, the real interesting twist to this particular photo, however, is that about 15 years or so ago, the Institution for Creation Research, which is out in California, that some of you may be familiar with, used this particular example as an example of how landforms were created by Noah's flood. All right, and on the landscape. So, I guess I told you there wasn't going to be any theology here, but one of the implications of these kinds of things is that at least some people believe that these are evidence that the flood actually did occur, and that's why they're out there. Certainly, there are innumerable interpretations of that. In Wisconsin, you can also find drumlins because they kind of contour plow around them. So, you can see that they planted the crops in such a way to accentuate the form of the drumlin, which was nice for whoever took this picture flying overhead. Another deposit that's real common is a deposit we call outwash, and that is the material that's carried by the meltwater of the glacier out to the front. And in this particular case, this is mostly sand and gravel. It's the same material that's in Railroad Creek, essentially. But you can think of Railroad Creek being this big. It's probably a mile across here, all right, at least. And you can see that the nature of this material is that there is not one channel, but several. And so what you get is a very conglomerated mixture of lots of gravel and sand. The other thing that happens here is that most of this ends up being pretty flat, so that you can recognize these areas in the modern landscape. Oftentimes, if you come across an area that's very flat, the two possibilities are either it's a lake sediment plain, there was a lake there one time, or perhaps this is what's happened. And another clue might be that if there's irrigation, center pivot irrigation systems on the top, it will be this material. This provides a lot of the good quality water for most of the Midwest, these kinds of deposits. So it is important to know about those. And I'm gonna kind of end up here with some shots of glaciers around here. This is the Lyman Glacier. And again, you see a little bit of a moraine deposit in front. There's now a lake in front of it. And you can see that the ice really isn't clean. You can see that there is a bluish cast to it that shows that it is actually a real glacier. And also the debris that's up in the ice, as the glacier moves over things, it does incorporate dirt that it's moving over by freezing it on, in most cases, and that's deposited in these kinds of deposits here. Here you see another view. Not a very big glacier, but it does meet all the criteria for it, and you can see that it's kind of dirty. Many of the glaciers here, you can see remnants of advances that took place over the last 4,000 years, and even within the last 100 years or so. Some of the glaciers in the Cascades have been fairly recently active, and have come out and made these little jumps out, made these moraines, and then have retreated. The bulk of the landscape here is older than that. And was deposited during the end of the Pleistocene, or what we usually call the Ice Age. But the ones up in these valleys here have had a little more recent activity. And here you can see debris in the ice itself. It's pretty dirty, the lake out in front. Lots of times these lakes will have that real kind of greenish cast, and that's not necessarily due to algae, it's as much due to the fine nature of the materials that are kind of causing a scattering effect of the light and actually causing that greenish tint. It's the same thing that happens if you go to a rock quarry and they've mined out the rocks and you can see that stuff flying around in there. Yes?
Those horizontal stripes represent periods of time or what?
Well, it's tough to say exactly what they represent, especially when you're near the margin where things get kind of bummed out or kind of bumped together. They could, if they're carried, sometimes layers of ice can be carried on through the glacier from the accumulation area. So remember the ice, the glacier starts up in what we call the accumulation area and snow falls on snow up there. That eventually works its way to the margin. Here, more than likely, near the margin, there is a lot of activity where the lower part of the ice slows down, but sometimes the upper part of the ice is still moving. So it moves, there's a tendency for ice to move over itself, and that creates sometimes banding like this that really reflects planes of movement near the end of the glacier. Shear planes is the common term for them. But you know, they may not have moved very much, but you know, it may be that basically if you go to the bottom of this ice, it hasn't moved for a long time, yet this upper stuff is still moving over the top of it. And that kind of creates a banding effect near the margin. Sometimes if you look closely, you'll see debris on the bottom of those, and that would suggest that debris is being carried up off the base and sometimes up near the margin. You can see, you know, some of this debris has probably fallen on top of it from the mountain, but some of it may actually have been brought up from the bottom. And it's you know, tough for me to look at the picture, and I haven't been up there yet, so I don't really know. Another view from higher up. These crevasse patterns tell us a lot about the type of flow the glacier is undergoing. In this case, we know that if the crevasses are going like this, that the glacier is pulling apart. And you would expect that to be the case if it was going down a slope. Where the glacier starts to slow up, and this is a pretty short one as well, it starts to make crevasses that sometimes may be visible as going this way rather than like this. The other interesting thing here is that in this particular shot, there's a hint that you can see the difference between what we call the accumulation area, which is where the snow still is, and what we call the ablation area where the snow has melted off. So at the end of a year, say in August or September, when the year's melting has stopped and when you're starting to go into winter, this line represents kind of the balance point of the glacier. So things are melting on this side, things are accumulating on this side, and if they're in balance, the glacier stays where it is. If you get more on this end, less and less melting, the thing is going to advance out this way. If you get more melting, it's going to go back. So that's a good example of that. Okay, so we're back here at Holden, and I guess what I tried to accomplish here today is just give you a little feel for the scale and the types of processes that are involved in the creation of this landscape. There's a real nice diorama up in the museum as you walk in on the left-hand side that kind of talks about how probably in this area there were streams that were here to begin with, and oftentimes glaciers are kind of lazy, they'll follow the stream valleys, and so most of these glaciers probably followed existing stream valleys but really deepened them out and made them considerably more spectacular than they might have been otherwise. And again, you know, when you're walking around the village, just kind of look up and see if you can recognize some of these features. And we don't have one of these, but that's a nice place to go if you get the chance. So I'll be happy to answer, you know, technical questions or other questions about this, and hopefully this is a little pretty good introduction to the subject here. And hopefully there are still some people awake. That's the it's lunchtime. Yeah.
Worldwide, glaciers are generally retreating, right? Is that because of global warming, or do they mean
what? I'll back up a little bit to answer that question. That the what we know is the Pleistocene epoch, or length of time, pretty much existed from about 2 million years ago to about 10,000 years ago, and presently we're supposed to be in what's called an interglacial. In other words, we're between glaciations. Not a particularly happy thought when you realize that if we went back into one, it wouldn't be very good. But so we're in a time period when a lot of things could be going on that depend a lot on fairly local climatic features. For example, in Alaska, it's fairly common to have side by side glaciers in different valleys doing different things. Okay, one would be galloping like crazy, you know, like the Bering Glacier was going nuts for a few years, then it stopped and it's gone back, and a number of these glaciers came out, did a bunch, and then have gone back. But they do different things, and it's not just the climate factor that's involved, because we find that in many of these glaciers there is not only climate involved, but that climate has to get translated into what the ice is doing and whether there's water at the base of the ice and all this kind of stuff, all right? So it's pretty complicated. Now, to answer your question directly, it's really too soon to really know, probably to notice the effect of global warming per se. For instance, you know, to get the ice age to start, you have to drop worldwide temperatures by a few to several degrees centigrade. Okay, obviously to get everything to melt, you have to go the other way. Well, we certainly haven't seen that worldwide, and we haven't been doing things long enough to really see that. So I don't think, at least on a worldwide scale, that we have seen the effects of that. And so probably the problem is that we see these kind of short-term effects. We're not really in a glacial period anyway, so things ought to be retreating. And how to interpret those in terms of climate and glacial dynamics and all this is really, really complicated. So unfortunately, the popular press picks up on glaciers retreating and pretty soon we're, you know, I'm sure if they were advancing, they'd say we were in the next ice age. You know, if they're retreating, it's global warming. So I think it's too soon to tell, and I think most people would agree with that. And the whole thing around glaciation is, we don't really understand, for instance, the exact causal mechanisms for the initiation of the ice age to begin with, let alone trying to figure out what mucking around with our present climate system is going to do. And there are people that are doing models and doing all this kind of stuff that are trying to approach that. Not me, but other people. So we had another question. Yeah, go ahead.
How fast do glacial surfaces travel? How fast can they travel?
Oh, well, you know, they can gallop, you know, in terms of, well, let's see, tens of feet per year. Surging glaciers, which are the ones that really go fast, can go in the range of hundreds of feet per year. And there have been numerous anecdotal information about, you know, people living down in the valley and suddenly the glacier decides to surge and you know, it'll just kind of bowl over houses and things like that. Normal glacial movement is, you know, maybe a meter or so a year front and back, unless it's, sometimes you can retreat faster because you're just melting all the stuff off, so. But they can move pretty fast. I mean, but, you know, the term glacially slow is kind of it's an interesting concept because not all glaciers move at the same rate, obviously. And, you know, if you're in the path of a glacier and it's surging, you know, it's not much comfort. So, but that's the kind of range we're talking about.
You said that the blue ice was a kind of had a plastic kind of attribute that made the glaciers move. Can you explain that?
Yeah, what happens during the transformation of snow to ice is that all the air gets compressed out and it actually becomes a metamorphic rock. So you can think of ice as a metamorphic rock. Metamorphic rock is something it's a changed rock, like so you could take sandstone and make it into a quartzite. And it's the pressure of the overlying snow on top and ice causes compression of that material and changes the quality of that, and it also changes the crystal structure of that so that it allows the material to do what we call deform. All right, so it makes it more like a plastic. You know, if you take certain kinds of plastic and you apply pressure over a small increment, it actually starts to bend before it breaks. And there are other substances that are like that. Well, in this case, you know, that's what happens to ice. So glaciers move by a combination of that deformation of the ice at a very slow rate, as well as a certain sliding component of the material as it slides down on the rock itself.
So the deformation lets it change shape and then it can slide further.
That's right, and it also provides movement. You can think of a glacier as, you know, if all the crystals are deforming, that allows them to kind of slip by each other, okay? And then so the glacier moves like this. So it's similar to how a river works. You know, there are, you know, there's, in a river, there are planes of motion that slip by each other, and it's just that ice is a little hard to conceptualize in that framework, but yeah. There's also some other mechanisms that are kind of controversial, but those are the two main ones. Anybody else here? I can tell you're all up ready for lunch here. Right?
If I understand correctly, the landform called an esker is created as water flows under the ice and then it's filled with debris, mm-hmm. Is that right? So you have something of a tube-like shape. But
yeah.
Now, I noticed you were backpacking in the wilderness area in Montana before coming here, and up in the high alpine meadows where the snowfields were melting and retreating, we saw tubes of soil that looked as though they could have been created by some kind of an animal under the ground, but in fact I think they might have been a similar feature. Mm-hmm. Is that in fact what those are?
Well, you can also, there's a lot of things that provide linear features. You know, you can also get material that gets kind of squeezed up into the bottoms of crevasses, you know, the cracks in the ice, that will form linear kind of features that end up looking like eskers, except they're a lot smaller. So, you know, there's right near the margin of the ice, there's a lot of things like that. But it could have been esker. I mean, eskers can be, you know, like house size on down to, you know, probably about this size. They don't get real small, generally.
Well, the feature I'm thinking of was, again, a snow field, not a glacier feature. And it almost looked like a mole had been...
Well, that's certainly possible.
Below the surface of the ground, but it,
or the water could have done that too.
That's what I
But you have to see, the interesting thing about eskers is that the ice is deforming the whole time.
Yeah.
All right. So the ice wants to close the opening. All right. So you have a constant interplay between the water coming through it, keeping the opening open, and the glacier trying to close it up. And at some point when that balance breaks down, then the eskers will either close up, or sometimes it fills with sediment for reasons that we don't really understand. So they're fascinating features. The other thing that will key you on to an esker is that, very much like river systems, they tend to be sinuous. So if you can see them on a, you know, from up above, they will tend to be snake-like. And actually, in most glaciers, you can see feeder eskers coming into maybe one main glacier, like you would in a stream drainage kind of system. Yeah, so there are a lot of the glacial landscape is very peculiar to anything else in geology, because there are things that are formed here that aren't formed anywhere else in the geologic record, and it's all because of the nature of ice being a kind of a bizarre substance. You realize, of course, this is my favorite thing about this is that you know, fortunately, ice is less dense than water. Otherwise, when lakes freeze in the winter, all the fish would die. Right? When lakes freeze, ice goes to the top because they're less dense. The cold water stays in the bottom because it's more dense, and the fish can stay. You look at anything else on the periodic chart of elements that acts like that, you know, H2 anything else. So H2O is weird. H2S, H2TE, H2 selenium, any of those act normally. Water's the weird one. And it's because of that weirdness that we're able to support life on the planet. So you can make anything out of that you will, but there's just something about that's definitely... And it was definitely put in place somehow. So. Yes. Yeah.
Is it safe to walk on glacier equipment?
Yeah. If you have the right equipment. I mean, you know, depending on, you know, sometimes you have to put, you know, kind of cleat-like device and so on, and have an ice axe. And sometimes if you're in a heavily crevassed area, you have to rope up. Because many times in an accumulation area, the crevasses will be covered with snow. So you'll walk into one, and this is real common to happen. So, and many people have been, I'm just being serious, people do walk into these, and they are transported through the glacier, and they, you know, recently find in the Alps, well, not recently, I mean, they find people all the time that have fallen into crevasses in the 1800s, 1700s. Even back, I think they recently, you know, what's that?
Was the Iceman that...
Well, the one that they had the big fight about, whose person it was, and
right.
And he was, I don't know, was he 5,000 years old or sometime? Pretty old. So, yeah, it's not, you have to know what you're doing, you have to know what features to look for, but, you know, Kathy and I have walked on glaciers before, and you just kind of stay away from the moulins and stay away from the crevasses, and you're fine. The only other problem is in a glacier that's melting is that if you're forming caves beneath, then what happens is the ice gets thin enough, it'll fall into those, and you don't want to fall in with. So, but generally, you just have to be careful. I mean, just like anything else. It's getting close to lunch here, so maybe we'll quit. I'm around for another week, so if you have questions, and I'll probably do this again, so if you want to come back, you're welcome to do that. And let's see. We don't have a glacial hike here because some of the stuff's hard to see and not easy to get to, but if you go on the mine hikes or the environmental hikes, I'll usually point out some stuff to you while we're on those, so feel free to come on those. Okay.
So if you go to Copper Basin, you can see the glacier up there, Copper Peak. It's easy to get to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Easy.
Except for the flies.
Yeah.
Holden Lake is, yeah, yeah. Mary Green Glacier is right up there. But think about these things when you're out looking around, because that's it'll make the stay here a little more enjoyable, I think.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.